is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. This is Guardian Radio AM, and I have the pleasure of sitting in on this program with you today. My name is Hubert Edwards, and it's always a pleasure to have the opportunity and the privilege to interact, to speak with, to engage with you. I'm sure that you are ready, you have your questions, you have your comments, you have your suggestions. So please feel free to call in to the numbers. I'm sure that many of you readily know them, but just in case you don't, I will share that with you very quickly. The numbers are 323-6232. 325-4259 and 325-4396. 323-6232, 325-4259 and 325-4316. And you may also text in on our text line, 422-GR96. I think it translates to 422-4796, 422-4796. So the question we have this morning is, what's happening in the world? What's happening out there today? There are many, many different things which we see. We were just about to, or at least so the narrative went, we were about to go to war. By we, I mean we in the world was about to see an invasion, Russia versus the Ukraine. Ukraine was saying, well, no, there's not going to be an invasion. The United States was saying, yes, there's going to be an invasion. Russia was saying, we're just having a couple of war games. We're doing some exercise. But eventually, yesterday, we heard good news, positive news, that there was a pullback. Not totally gone, but there was a pullback. Why is this important to us? It's important because a war, at this point in time, recovering from this global financial crisis, the financial aspect of the crisis, the economic side of the crisis, would be detrimental to the world. It certainly would involve additional strain on supply chains. It would involve additional strain on oil, on certain other resources which comes out of Europe, and so on and so forth. And so we definitely are not in a place and a time where armed combat is ideal. There's never an ideal time for armed combat, where persons lose their lives, persons are going to die innocently, there's going to be casualty of war. But with us coming out of this global financial crisis, a high level of inflation, we are in a high inflationary environment. Europe is showing record levels at 5+. The United States is up to record levels in 40 years. And certainly the Bahamas is reeling from that. We heard in the news today, just now, we're talking about the inflationary environment and the growing demand for social support, And so if you want to chime in on any of these things, the numbers, let's talk. I have one or two things I want to run by you, we want to discuss. So let's talk about them. Before I go further, I am going to just pause here to say to the many persons who would have reached out to me send notes, comments, kind notes on my appointment to the chair of the Economic Development Committee at Organization for Responsible Governance. And I want to thank Robert Myers, Matt Aubrey, and the rest of the team there. First thing I need to debunk, which many people think, and so they have started to make plans to withdraw the monies that they initially planned on giving to me. A lot of persons think that this is a paid gig. It's not. It's a voluntary position. It's a position which gives the opportunity to serve an organization and, in turn, most importantly, absolutely the most important aspect of that for me is about serving the country. And so, as you would be aware, many of you would be aware, I've done some work in this area. It's something which I have a passion for. I previously served as the chair of the Economic Committee for the Bahamas Chamber of Commerce and Employee Confederation. And so I see this really as just an extension of that. It's about national service. And we are going to do this in such a way where we are going to reach out and find all of the persons who can help, who can support, and who can help, figure out how to work as a team to move the country forward. And so, as we move forward, some of the things that we'll be looking at is, how to get into the conversation about sustainable economic growth, how to get into the conversation about fiscal responsibility and debt management, how to get into and influence the conversation about workforce development and productivity. We want to start to really, really have some serious conversation around accountable governance, economic development, education, and the impact on that. We'll talk a little bit about education today. We also want to talk about fiscal strategy and how those strategies are being directed towards moving the country and fixing the challenges, the real challenges on the ground. I know there are discussion in the year about taxation and tax reform, revenue reform, energy reform, how to diversify the tourism product, how to retain more of the income from tourism, how to look at the growth of SMEs and the support that comes from organizations like the SBDC, and how do we facilitate the growth thereafter. Collaboration with Family Island Development, Family Island Efforts, Abaco, Grand Bahama, all the way down to Inagua. Really want to use this opportunity to make a serious mark, a serious change on how we do conversations around growth and national development. This is, for me, a great privilege. I'm not into this in any way, shape, or form to be aggrandized. I want this to be a platform where we use our influence, where we use our reach to bring persons together with the view of, in the first instance, where necessary, to change the conversations, and to change the conversations in such a way that they become, in my mind, more productive, more pointed, more strategic, and more designed to do what governance ought to be doing, and that is to deliver value for the greater good in all instances. And so, to you out there, I say, thank you, and thanks to ORG for the opportunity. So what is happening in your world? What are some of the big issues that are concerning you at this point in time? I talk about the war, or at least the tensions which are out there. Let's not dismiss that. Let's keep an eye on it, because it has serious geopolitical implication, and we want to ensure that that goes away totally. I think Putin is playing some level of chicken, if you will, with the United States. Let's see who wins. What about the issues of the DRA and the disclosures and the big contracts which are coming out of there? Without getting into the specifics of any of those, here is one of the areas which I want to focus on. It has become blatantly clear as we change from administration A to administration B, then back to administration A, and then to administration B, that in between those spaces, there's always great revelation of the weaknesses, some of the challenges, some potential wastage that happens from a financial economic perspective. And the question is, how can we fix this? How will we change this dynamic? How will we change this paradigm? Because in the end, the country suffers. The country suffers. The country has significantly limited resources. We have gone through a pandemic which has exacerbated our fiscal situation, has driven the debt to historical levels, and has essentially weakened the resiliency of the country, the ability to bounce back from external and internal shocks, if you will. And so we have to now start to keep an eye, more than one, we have to keep all our eyes on this old idea of, hey, where are we as a country? How are we protecting the resources? We know that within any system, whether it is corporation or as big and complex as government, there's going to be some wastage, there's going to be some losses, and it will come through many means. It may be pilferage, it may be where individuals deliberately, through collusion or otherwise, find ways of, you know, accruing or accreting the resources to themselves, stealing. But what we often do not pay enough attention to are those losses, significant losses that take place through the formal system, the formal process, where the thing is agreed, budgeted for, signed off on, spent, but at the end of the day, the result, the value which is desired, is not delivered. And because that value is not delivered, but the need still exists, we now need to go back and spend again to solve the circumstance, to solve the situation, which means that if the cost was $1 in the first instance, the $1 was spent, it was expended fully or mostly out of pocket for $1. But if the need still arises, if the resolution, if the solution is not optimal, then we'll have to go back and spend another dollar or a large portion thereof. So that which was supposed to cost in the first instance only a dollar is now costing the country more. And that more then again becomes subject to the vagaries of the extent to which this additional spending becomes fundamental, becomes effective, becomes the facilitator for real and sustainable solutions. And so we have to be very, very mindful, and we have to be very, very careful that these discussions are not simply about who did what and pointing fingers and seeking to undermine agendas. It's really about the fundamental survival of a country. And why I say survival is within the context of this point in time, we are at, I believe, at our weakest point in recent history to tolerate losses, to tolerate wastage, to tolerate spending which is based on, you know, programs and projects and initiatives which are not well thought out, or if they are well thought out, are not properly executed. We are at our weakest. And the reason we are at our weakest is because our resources are highly limited. And if the resources are highly limited and the thing must be done, we are therefore forced to go and secure that largely through additional funding and borrowing. And the truth is, the Bahamas is today, right as we speak, at a place where it is really not able to borrow in real terms. Does it have the capacity to borrow? Yes. Is there persons out there who would lend to the Bahamas? Most definitely. Could the Bahamas borrow right now, today, at a price, especially in the international markets, at a rate which would be reasonable and which would, in at least after the fact, if we're judging the administration, would we consider it to be prudent for them to, given where our bonds at this point in time, would we consider prudent for them to borrow at this level? I would think not. So while the statement I made is that the Bahamas is not able to borrow, it's not absolute statement. It's really not right now, right here in this moment, a prudent thing to do, especially in the international market. And unfortunately for the government, this pricing change, this significant uptick in the yield of national bond has seemingly seeped into the domestic market. And it has seeped into the domestic market in a kind of insidious way, a strange way, one which is challenging and one which is in many ways perplexing, kind of paradoxical, using a lot of P words there. And the reason is this. In the normal course, risk management, credit risk granting, credit risk underwriting, the sovereign of a country, the government, the country itself, when the country borrows, it's typically seen as the lowest credit exposure. Typically seen as that. But there is an interesting phenomenon, which is air in the Bahamas right now. It didn't just occur. It has been there for a couple of months, maybe even a couple of years now, over the last 2 years or so, where the sovereign is unable to borrow at rates which are favorable to private concerns. In other words, if the government borrows today, it pays more, and in some instances, maybe much more than a private concern. That, I think, is a development which requires careful analysis and careful assessment. It's not a good thing. It's not a good trend. It's sending a message that there is a prevailing sentiment, view, a thinking amongst those who would be lenders as to what the credit risk profile of the government, of the country, of the sovereign is. And based on the premiums, I call it premiums, if we apply the benchmark rate, I think it's 4.25, there are rates which our government is borrowing at maybe north of in the domestic market, maybe trending towards 6. Don't quote me on those that are concrete, but they're higher than the benchmark. Those premium, the premium on loans or the premium on the possibility of borrowing at those levels is suggesting that the underwriters, the institutions, see the government as an increased risk, credit risk. And credit be, if you were in an institution, one of these fancy institutions underwriting that, you would say to yourself, based on the rates which have been put out there, that the government's, the sovereign probability for default has increased and increased markedly. Why is this important? Because if the government is at this point in time challenged in accessing the international market, taking into consideration that the previous budget deficit, as best as I am aware, is still yet to be totally funded. So if the government is challenged in doing that, and I would think would be imprudent at this point in time in doing so, and is also a challenge in securing in the local domestic market, in the domestic currency, then there is a view, there is a message, there is a sentiment that something needs to be remediated. And how we fix that, how we tackle that conversation is important because it's part and part of the strategy going forward, given the stock of debt that we have. So we are really at a stage, at a place where, you know, it's critical. It's critical. Again, if you want to call in, you can call the numbers. I am doing this show remotely. And so we have to be able to be very skillful in trying to get that information in. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, really want to hear from you, want to have a discussion around how are these things going to impact us, the inflationary environment. I want to talk a little bit about school kids. I have a little thought about three particular segments. It's troubling, which is bothersome. And so when we come back on the other side of Guardian AM, we want to have the chat. You're listening to Guardian Radio AM. I'm your host, Hubert Edwards, and this is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Don't move. Come right back.
Always on the go. Miss the show? Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Loss of family members is very isolating, and people who have experienced loss appreciate when others have shared their grief. If you can't be there in person, go to the Nassau Guardian at thenassauguardian.com and visit our obituary link. The Nassau Guardian's interactive obituary link allows you to read the funeral announcement, express condolences, or place photos on the online guestbook for one full year. Losing a loved one is painful, but that pain isn't the worst thing to happen. Friends, loved ones, colleagues, and neighbors who ignore the loss compound the pain. Should the bereaved family wish to place the obituary and photos on our obituary site, just contact the Guardian's funeral industry partners or the Nassau Guardian. Remember, there isn't one magic right thing to say to someone experiencing loss that will make the loss less painful or easier to bear. The Nassau Guardian's obituary link, available online at guardian.com.
Hello, I'm Jermaine Kemp, a patient care assistant at Sunland Rehabilitation Center. I am one of many standing proudly on the front line of healthcare during the global COVID-19, and I am vaccinated. I made the decision to get the AstraZeneca vaccine after attending information session to learn more about it. I felt it was important that I did not spread the COVID-19 to my family, friends, and most importantly, my patients. My patients depend on me for their care, and I consider it a privilege to serve. I invite you to join me in keeping our clients, colleagues, and community safe by choosing to be vaccinated. We can do this, Bahamas. Together, we can beat COVID-19 one vaccination at a time.
This message has been brought to you by the Public Hospitals Authority and the Sandilands.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to Guardian AM. We just had a, you know, brief salvo, if you will, on some financial, some geopolitical, the potential for war, the issues around the inflationary circumstances, and the fact that right here in the Bahamas, there's a significant increase in food costs going to have a knock-on social effect. We've heard about the growing demand for social support. And so when we talk about these things, they're really cutting across many aspects of life. It's not just the pure, narrow, raw economic issues at play. Lives are being turned up. But, you know, one of the things I think we have to do in this moment is that while there are great challenges, while there are great, great challenges, significant challenges, don't want to underplay that. We have to understand and appreciate that it also presents an opportunity for great changes, for great reforms, because it's the it says that we are seeing, the things which are being thrown up, which are going to guide us as to the changes which need to be made. And so we don't have to necessarily remain in the same level, with the same level of vulnerability, if and when we go through another crisis. We have a text that says, good morning, we are becoming a nation of corruption is the order of the day. As simple as on the roads today, there's lawlessness and total for other law-abiding drivers. The police need to enforce the laws without bias. Now, the way you started, I read your entire text, but I'm going to disagree with you on the first point. The country is not a nation of no return. Where we are currently, in my mind, yes, we are challenged. Yes, we see some things which ought not to be. Yes, we see some things which are easily fixed, in my opinion, if there is the will to fix it. But the truth is, the country and the issues that we have around maybe potential corruption, losses, pilferage, wastage, and so on, they're fixable. You see, at the end of the day, all of these things require the application of certain tools. They require the application of laws. They require the application of policies. They require the application of rules, ethics, all of that sort of thing. These are things which are done elsewhere and can be done right here. But most importantly, we need to understand and appreciate that those are tools. First and foremost, everything rises and falls and turns on leadership. And the moment the leadership, at whatever level it engages, the moment the leadership takes the view that this is the end of that, it will happen. It must happen. It have to happen. And this is really what governance is about. Governing a country is never, ever going to be easy, no matter the size, because, you know, it's a lot of people, it's a lot of moving parts, there's a lot of objectives and views and desires which have opposing tension. But at the end of the day, this is where leadership comes in. This is where leadership sits in the middle, wherever leadership sits, and decide this is the way to go. We have to get to the place where we start to recognize that, no, we don't throw our hands up and say we are a country of no return. We do recognize the points that you made subsequently of police officers enforcing the law, persons being asked to be socially responsible, persons being asked to understand that if corruption, we are going to find you and we're going to send you to the darkest part of Fox Hill, and there's going to be a price to be paid. So those are the things that we can do. Great show as usual. I don't think war will happen, mainly because Ukraine don't want no war, they ain't in no drama, and also USA telling Russia, you feel froggy, just jump. The USA have been waiting for a long time to put hands on Russia. So Russia President Putin head ain't no good, but he ain't stupid. Russia head ain't good, but he ain't stupid. So there will war. Well, I don't know if the Ukraine really has no big say in this whole thing, to be honest, Texer. The Ukraine would be, you know, the recipient of the aggression from Russia. The United States have a big part to play, because obviously Ukraine would have the protection of NATO and the allies we're part of. And consequently, I don't think that Russia wants to get into a war with this. But there's more things at play. I think there is greater subtleness on the ground, which is, if you think about the prominence which Russia enjoyed during the last United States administration under President Trump, and if you contrast and compare that with some of the stance really of the new administration under Biden, you would see that, you know, some things are waning. And it is clear that of a friend of Russia than President Trump was or is. And consequently, there is some flexing of geopolitical muscle at play here. In the wings is also China. China and GP is there. They're flexing their global geopolitical muscle. They want to remind the United States that it's not the only big boy on the block. They want to be too. They want to see significance. They want to be, you know, part and parcel of this big world order. Russia has been squeezed out of a number of these organizations, large effect and the influence of the United States. And so, you know, this is maybe a part of that. And Ukraine may very well be one of the trump card, no pun intended, and they're going to be using it to great effect. Great show as usual, but it's another side to the Russian-Ukraine situation. War makes billions of dollars between countries. Military warfare makes billions. Yes, there is an economic side to it. And whosoever is supplying the equipment, whoever is supplying the guns and the ammunition and the machines, stands to make a lot of money if there is war. Obviously, after there's a war, when you knock down the bridges, when you knock down the buildings, they have to be rebuilt. So, you know, war itself have its own unique economics. And largely, the people who tend to benefit from war the most are those who have the ability to go in and help the country sort themselves out. The judiciary needs to be independent of legislature so they can prosecute these politicians who practice malfeasance. Their assets and proceeds should be confiscated and returned back to the state if found guilty. Okay, so let's start first. The judiciary needs to be independent. There is a little bit of a nuanced discussion here in terms of that statement. Because the judiciary is appointed by the executive. But only to that extent can one argue that there is maybe lack of independence. In terms, if the judiciary does its job based on the underlying structures which it has been afforded, based on the constitutional protections which are in place, then it is effectively very, very, very independent of the executive. So we know that the prime minister or the administration, the ruling administration in any point in time, appoints, you know, judges and appoints important individuals within judiciary, the chief justice and so on and so forth. But beyond that, it is independent. And the way we have seen the judiciary plays out its role in the Bahamas, I think one would be hard-pressed to levy a accusation that it doesn't operate independently. Now, you may have a desire to see persons be prosecuted and sent to jail or this, but bear in mind that the principle still holds that the man is considered to be innocent until proven guilty, and the process of proving guilt is important. So if you can present somebody to court, but you are not able to provide the evidence, the supporting evidence to prove that guilt beyond a shadow, well, not beyond a shadow of a doubt, because it's not be reasonable doubt. If you're not able to do that, then obviously you can't convict the individual, and that individual will have to go free. So I believe that the judiciary is independent in many regard. I believe that the demonstration and the behavior of the judiciary in the Bahamas is in many ways exemplary in the way it separates itself from government and as a part of government in real terms, because government strictly is the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. I think it has played its role well. Now, do we want greater advocacy coming from the judiciary like we see maybe in the United States, where we know we have conservative judges and liberal judges who are appointed and they put their... No, I really don't think we should get to that place. We know who appoint them. We sometimes suspect that they are particularly leaning, but we highly hope based on their behavior today that when it comes to, you know, prosecuting the law and making judgment based on the law, you know, we've seen it done. We've seen a couple of cases which have taken, made their way all the way to the Privy Council, but it's not a deluge. We have seen rulings locally which have been overturned by the Privy Council, but it's not a lot. It's a few, you know, very few. So we have to give the judiciary credit for what they've done. The government need to intervene in the BTC matter, where they're forcing their employees to get vaccinated when there is no mandatory compulsion. We the people own 51%. Well, we the people own 51%. Some other persons own 49%. BTC is really a private concern. And I think this question would turn on whether or not it is a legal thing for a corporation to compel their staff, compel employees to be vaccinated. I don't know the answer to that. I know that the government doesn't have a mandate. There's no mandate. There's no vaccination mandate. I think the country is at maybe about 50-50 right now. And you know, my personal view is that maybe that's as far as we will get given the turn of events. But whether or not the government would step in and say, "I don't do this," it can obviously use its influence because it controls 51%. But as we ask these questions, as we say these things, I think we need to reflect on that 51%. Because if BTC makes a decision, if the board of BTC, which is represented, which the government has representation on by virtue of its 51% holding, if the board, if BTC as a corporate entity made a decision, then clearly, by extension, those who have oversight really have no challenge, no issue with what has been done. And so it may very well be that it's a matter best left for legal arbitration. It may be that it's a matter best left for those who may be willing to take it to court or to find some sort of legal solution to argue that out to see whether or not they actually have the ability to do so. So just that I went through them comprehensively and provided some feedback. I want to turn right now to this issue of education and schools. Because there's something about this crisis, this COVID crisis, this global crisis, which scares me a lot, very, very much. And this scaring is, you know, it's informed largely by my background, you know, where I'm from, how I grew up. Not where I'm from, but how I grew up. Grew up very, very poor, in humble circumstances, and fully understand the vagaries of being poor, and fully understand the vagaries of, or at least fully understand the implications of not having an education, of not being afforded an education. And so while the, in this instance, I've seen the Minister of Education doing the rounds and making, you know, very sound statements, I would believe, and trying to get persons going, visiting schools. That's great. Kudos to her. Here is what I'm a little bit concerned about. Preschool students who are now have or will be transitioning to, say, grade 1-7. Many of them have lost about 2 years. Many of them. We can clearly conclude that many of them have lost about 2 years. And so they're not really at the level. Some of them are not reading. They're not numerate at the level which they ought to be. And then there is my next grouping, the grade 4 to grade 6 students. So they were in grade 4 or grade 5 or grade 6 when COVID really started to hit. And over the last 2 years, they have now either are terminating at grade 6 and ready to get ready. They're getting ready for grade 7, or they have actually transitioned to grade 7, but have not really did for that transition. Many weren't logging into virtual school. Many have not gotten the type of nurturing because they need special focus and special attention. And then there is the group in which I think is the most concerning one for me, and that is the grade 10 to 12. Many students in this grouping have now found themselves on the outside of the schooling system because of age or because they would naturally finish the transition into the school. You know, you move from grade 10 to grade 11 to grade 12, and so you're now out. But those kids have not maybe in the last 2 years or so, 24 months or so, they have not absorbed, they have not been taught not because of the fault of the teachers or the fault of the education system, but larger because they have not presented themselves. And there's also those who presented themselves but have not really flourished because the style, the approach of teaching through a virtual platform is just not good for them. It's not conducive to their style of learning. I'm really concerned about these individuals. Why am I concerned about them? The young children who are transitioning into primary school, preschool into primary school, they're going to struggle. And if the foundation is not there, they're likely to have significant challenge as they move forward. And given the fact that, based on my analysis, I believe that we embrace social promotion in this country as we do in many other countries within the region, it becomes challenging. And so the question is, where are we going to create a pause? Where are we going to create a stop? Where are we going to create that intervention to identify and fix, remediate these challenges where they exist? Because if we don't, there is a burden on the side of the cycle. We are creating potentially a vicious cycle if we don't interact. And I'm sure that those in the Ministry of Education, those in that apparatus are looking at these things. They understand, they know it. All I'm simply doing here is drawing a concern of mine to the fore. The preschool students and those who are transitioning into high school, they have some time. And some of them may get it. They may be up and running because they're smart, because they're predisposed, because they have the support at home and so on and so forth, because they may have the interaction from coaches and mentors and bigger brothers and sisters or from church. However that process happened, they have some time. But those individuals who now find themselves on the outside of the school system, having not gotten the necessary learn the necessary things which is going to prepare them for the world of work, prepare them for the next level, I'm really, really concerned about them, because this translates into now women to go out and be productive citizens, to take on responsibility. Some of them are going to start families. Some of them have started families, unfortunately. And this is going to translate into challenges. And so when we talk about, really, at the top, the whole financial issues, the economic issues, the need to tackle waste, the need to get governance right at a fundamental level, these are some of the attendant effects. These are some of the challenges, because governance is there to serve the greater good. But it just got a little bit more difficult. It just got a little bit more challenging. And so where are the interventions going to come from? If we take a quick look at a report which came out from the World Bank, one of the things that it mentioned is that, it reads here, equally important for avoiding long-term scarring, and this is talking about the effect that the downturn will have on individuals, their economic situation. For economic scarring from the pandemic is helping primary students recoup education losses, particularly those in vulnerable households. Very, very important. Let me read that again. Equally important in avoiding long-term scarring from the pandemic is helping primary and secondary students recoup education losses, particularly those in vulnerable households. So, so very serious. If I put myself in the shoe of those individuals, back in the day, if I was going through this pandemic, I would be in a vulnerable household. I would be, without even thinking about it. My mom would not have been able to afford some of the things. And so we get by because things were normal. We made it happen. You know, we survived. Surviving in this circumstance and not being able to go to school and to get to, it would have been totally detrimental. And so give me a lease if I just add one additional thing. If that was me in that vulnerable circumstance, not education, not being able to take advantage of that, my circumstances today would have been dire. I wouldn't be here having this conversation with you. You see what I'm saying? My children, because, you know, I'm a grown man and I still would have children at some point in time, my children would suffer from that circumstances having happened a long time ago. This is what we're grappling with. And this is what we really, really need to fix. And as the Texas spoke about dealing with the, you know, abiding by the laws and doing the things which are necessary to pull us forward, there's one other area which we need to be mindful of. And the World Bank, in its statement, spoke to this very, very clearly. It's very important. Failure to reach political consensus on fiscal adjustment and the structural reform agenda could have detrimental impacts on growth of consumer, business, or investor sentiment. Low trust in government in Latin America and the Caribbean is a further source of downside risk. Why would I read that? Because of this. These big discussions we're having about big contracts and all of that feeds into this old sentiment of lack of trust of government. It also feeds into the sentiment of there being a divide on what the consensus should be on the way forward in terms of fiscal reform, structural reforms, and so on and so forth. If we're going to fix the country, if we're going to fix our circumstances, if we're going to grapple with our debt, if we're going to make the path clearer for those who are currently struggling but will have a better future because of the disruption that they've just gone through in losing educational opportunities, in losing economic opportunities, in reduced income and so on and so forth, those things will have to be fixed. Person says, great show as usual, the word poor, don't use the word poor. You were unfortunate or underprivileged because eating mud pie is at its poorest level. Well, I was poor. No shame in that. I was poor. Was unfortunate. Yeah, we can use that. But I was poor. I was underprivileged. I don't like that one. But yeah, I get what you're saying. But there's nothing wrong with saying you were poor. The fact of the matter, it is. Another one quickly. Another thing. How will not just the Bahamas, but how will the world be 10 years from now, suffering from the fact kids now miss about 3 years of education? Well, what it translates to is that there will be some persons who will get on with life swimmingly. They will be able to do what they have to do, and they'll be fine. And then there will be a larger portion. The problem is for the country, as we focus on the Bahamas, there may be a greater number of persons who are living at or below the poverty line. It will impact the productivity of the country. It will impact the need for government to provide social support, and it therefore impacts the ability of the country to be productive and to grow and to develop. And so it becomes a potential vicious cycle. And so as we move forward, we have to start fixing all of these things in a very serious way. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is really the end. I thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Textures, for participating. We got quite a number of texts. I hope I dealt with them well. But as we go out and as we end, we need to understand and we need to appreciate that we are here to fix our country, to work with our country, to make sure that at the end of the day, we are in a better position. And so as I leave you, I will leave you with the 8 principles of good governance, which is not only for government, but also for us as individuals. Accountability, transparency, responsiveness, effectiveness and efficiency, rule of law, equity and inclusiveness, participation and consensus oriented. For you listening, participation is the way to go. I want to say to you, thank you for listening. And we usually end by saying one love, one good and Ubuntu.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas. Social Service.